M-A-K-E-N-Z-I-E.
L-M-A-R.
Dang. I thought you were, okay, you extended
I
the
still
last
did
syllable.
It. Oh, yeah, I still it. Did okay. it. Okay, thank
All right.
you.
We're doing Gone Girl today, and it's going to be a fun one, despite the subject matter of this film. And I have to throw down a spoiler. Well, do you want to throw down the spoiler warning right off the bat here?
Yeah, let's just do it. I mean, it's been a while, y'all, so turn around. Don't drown. It's spoiler time.
The reason we have to throw that down so early in the episode is for today's cold open. I want to talk about your favorite female villain in cinema, television, take that however you like. But I think the mastermind in this that we'll sort of talk about later, I think she's up there. But who's yours?
Oh, my God. So this is so hard. And I have so many questions back for you. So, okay. So you said film or TV.
Yes.
Or TV. So that's a thing. Animated?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or not animated? All
we
the
don't discriminate
things.
Here.
Yeah. We don't discriminate. Okay. Well, the thing that popped into my head when you asked me immediately was Maleficent.
Oh, yeah. Going way back.
I do like a Maleficent moment. There are several other like real ones that I also like, but she's probably the animated one. I was thinking about this as we were prepping. I also really like, well, she's villain-ish, Miranda Priestly in The Devil Wears Prada.
You know, I've never seen that. We need to do that for the pod because it's one that's been on my radar, but I've never gone out of the way. We need to just cover it, you know?
We do, because it's really like, I know a lot of people can write it off as a chick flick or whatever, but it's real good. And Meryl Streep is so good. But yeah, that's part of it. She plays Miranda Priestly and she does such a great job. And she sort of begrudgingly, you like her for various reasons, but she's definitely a villain. She's definitely like a bad guy.
Backtracking really quick, when you said Maleficent, you said the animated. Are you linking in the Angelina Jolie take on it as well? I didn't see that.
No, I was just talking about the animated version. I mean, not that I don't like her version, but I just like, if I picture like old school villains that I watched and I loved, it was like Maleficent and Ursula, you know, for the animateds. Those were my favorites. They were so good. And then I'm trying to think of other real life ones, but definitely Miranda Priestly is one of the first ones that came to mind. And then actually genuinely this one, she does such a great job in this. Like it is as Amy, amazing Amy, whatever. She's so good at being such a villainous creep.
Do you think like, I feel like it's so easy at this point in time. And I don't want to make light obviously of any real world stuff, but I feel like it's so easy at this point in time that we always categorize these characters as sort of sociopaths. Would you put her in that box? Or is she just hyper intelligent and knows what she wants and is kind of manipulating the world around her to get it?
I don't think she's a sociopath. I don't think she's a full blown sociopath. I think she still has some humanity, albeit limited. But I do think most of this is about conquest and achievement.
Yeah.
For her, right? Accomplishment, achievement. I think it's less about feelings than it is like, this is worthy of me. This is something I have achieved or accomplished or what have you.
Cool.
Who would you say is yours? I'm still feel like I haven't maybe thought of one that's probably staring.
There's
me in the
so,
face,
I mean, I what, did it. I Googled yeah. a list and when we could have done a Lushmore on this of just pick your, we could have gone
of
a
just
top
pick
10.
Your best.
There's so many great ones that I didn't really think of. But we just watched Misery for the first time in October.
Oh my God, that's such a good one.
And Kathy Bates
crushes
it in that as Annie. Just terrifying, but kind of alternates between these two facets of her personality. And just that is such a great horror movie and a great King. I think it's one of Stephen King's favorite adaptations of his. So I would go with Annie probably as my number one.
She's really good. That's a great pick. I think she's really good at being a total creep, but yeah, like you said, just marrying that with some of her sweeter personality traits, probably peppered in there. It's probably a good way to think of it.
Could I also take the entire cast of Mean Girls collectively. I know that they God. Turn it around by the end, but for most of the movie, they're kind of all mean.
To be honest, you know, Regina George is really likable in a lot of ways, unfortunately. Katie Heron's almost a worse version of her because she mm-hmm. saw the format and then she straight up did it despite Bought everything she it. Knew. Yeah. So, no, definitely those are some villains for sure.
And if we're going to go TV-wise, I think Cersei Lannister's got to be up there. I mean, you got a few interesting ones on Game of Thrones, but I think Cersei is probably number one.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's one that's worse than her in that, but probably not. I mean, hopefully you guys have all seen this by now, but, you know, Dany, the sad part about Dany is that she shouldn't have ended up as one of the best villains, but if you look at her as a villain at the end... She has a very interesting arc.
I saw what they were going for with that. I don't want to get it. We can do a whole episode. I mean, we do drink and watch things. We can do a Game of Thrones episode.
We should.
Something. But I saw what they were going for. It just didn't feel earned with how quickly it happened. But you could have convinced me that her upbringing and all these circumstances led to her downfall. It just was like, flip of a hat.
I 100% agree. I think that's the consensus, right? Is like, you could have gotten there, but you could not have gotten there that quickly. That's the problem. They tried to flip a switch on us and we were not buying it. I wasn't buying it personally.
You said flip a switch. I said flip of a hat. I don't think that's an expression. What I said. The other thing, guys, that I want to point out, the other reason this is going to be a fun episode is this is a back-to-back for us. I put on the glasses to sort of like give the illusion that it's a different week.
I just fluffed my hair. I don't know. I don't know if it worked.
A little more volume. But we did just do, we just recorded our Emilia Perez episode where we did a shot at the beginning as well as our regular drinks. So this is, Gone Girl is going to be a fun one.
We needed some joy, you know? And I will say, this one weirdly gives me a lot of joy. I think this is going to be a fun time. Oh, all right. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And we are starting a whole new month here on the pod. If you haven't heard, this is Love Stinks, which I hope is implied what that means, but it's non-romantic stories. I mean, they're partnerships gone awry, perhaps, love stories that didn't work out. And it's really in a response to February that will never be Valentine's month for us. So we're going to kick things off with Gone Girl. Which is
this was only my second watch through, and it's
might have been third.
I'm pretty sure this was number two, and I still remembered a lot because it's what year did this come out? This was
2014. Yeah.
So I remembered a lot about it, and I remembered how it played out, but I was still excited to rewatch this, and second time through, equally enjoyable. No, even more so knowing how things play out because you're tracking a lot of the earlier half of the film. So yeah, excited to talk about it.
I'm excited too. I think this is a good time. Like it's a gnarly show and it's a gnarly subject matter. But I think we just like, I thought there was such a this was such a great way to kick off the month is what I would say. This is, we are at 100 with relationships that go awry. So anyway, with that in mind, we had a whole conversation about this off mic. What are we drinking?
Well, we were trying to drink a concoction made by At Craft World. So this is, or was supposed to be, 2 ounces of bourbon, 0.25 ounces of mezcal, 0.75 ounces of lemon juice, 0.75 ounces of honey syrup. You shake that up, put it over a big rock. And then, as always, guys, neither of us is good at doing red wine floaters. Those were the instructions that Skylar gave us. I mean, it's messy.
It's not a float. It's a sink. It's a solid sunk floater.
I thought I was doing a great job, and I was pouring it over the spin. I saw some catching the top and was like, I'm doing it. I'm finally doing it, Peter.
I know.
Then I was like, why is it not? And I realized there was another batch of it pooling at the bottom. So by the time I finished, it was half red wine, half the other. I took a sip and realized this is a mess. I don't even want to call this what it's supposed to be called, but...
It's the drink. And it's going to be a drink because, yes, exact same experience. I definitely had the floater going. I thought I was batting 1,000 as far as I could tell. And then I looked down and it's so much wine. And I guess he's going to find out now. I didn't want to open a whole new bottle of red wine. So I used an open dessert wine, which is, by the way, not what you would typically put in one of these. And so now there's way too much of it. This is probably going to be terrible. But anyway,
well,
cheers.
I mean, but if Ben Affleck in this, if Nick is not going to put that much effort into naming his bar and just call it the bar,
yeah,
then why should we put any effort into making this drink called the drink? You know, it's
right?
kind of suiting. Like,
yeah, kidding. It was intentional. That's what it was. All right. Mm-hmm. Cheers.
Cheers.
Oh,
also, I wanted to... I'm basically so just drinking shitty red wine at this point. I took really good wine and made it shitty with other ingredients. But I wanted to point out
so bad.
That the bar in this, they did actually open an establishment called The Bar here. It ended up closing a few years after. But funny enough, Janelle and I were in Phoenix last week, and there's a bar there called The Bar. I'm sure it's not the only one nationwide, but you can still go to The Bar in Phoenix if you can't make it to the one that was in Gone Girl. Because it's close.
As Kim Dickens says in this, very meta of them. And I like it. I actually think it's cute. But yeah, I think I bombed the drink. Sorry. My bad. All right, homies. We're going to go through the basics so we can get to the fun stuff. This is Gone Girl 2014. This has an 8.1 out of 10 on IMDb. An 88% from critics on Rotten Tomatoes and an 87% from audiences. So I feel like that's some pretty solid universal acclaim across the board. So, I mean, not terribly surprising given that our director here is Mr. David Fincher, who's incredible. But just for the subject matter, you wouldn't necessarily assume that everybody loved this and pretty well received.
I mean, it's entertaining for as dark as it is. It is captivating and really, I hesitate to use the word fun, but it's engaging to watch.
It's kind of fun though. Yeah. It is kind of fun. So David Fincher, as I said, our director here, if you don't already know, has done things like Seven, Zodiac, The Social Network, which I think you can just tell by the aesthetic almost of the film, like the way that it's shot, the coloring, like you can look at a film and be like, oh, David Fincher shot, you know, did this film. Mm-hmm. The color here is just so clearly his style. And so are those other ones as well. I think it's such a great time to watch his work in general.
Now, did this win? I don't know if you're going to cover this, but do you know offhand, did this win Oscars? I know it had nominations. Did it win anything?
I don't think it won anything that I recall, at least. Nothing that stands out to me, no. I wasn't doing, to be fair, at this time, I wasn't doing my annual watch every single thing. Mm-hmm. So doesn't stand out. But
I know Rosamund Pike was nominated. I don't know if this got a director's nod, but I doubt it got Best Picture because I think at that point it was still 5 films. I could be wrong. But yeah, I don't think it won for much if it did win at all.
No, it looks like she was nominated for Best Actress, but it didn't win anything.
Okay.
So, yeah.
That's deserved, though. She crushes it.
She crushed it. Yeah, 100%. The writer here, though, also did a great job. Source material is very solid. This is Gone Girl, same name, by Miss Gillian Flynn, who was the author of the book, but also the screenplay. And yes, I have the book. Who doesn't want to read
it? When that happens, when they get the author of the book to do the screenplay. I'm trying to think of another example, but I know there's at least one or two other films where I really enjoyed that was the case.
Yeah, I just think that, you know, if they can do it well, they translate their work the best, right? Mm-hmm. And not everybody can, but she can. Her other work has been made into TV series multiple times, movies. She did Sharp Objects, which I also have on the back of the bookshelf that I'm pointing to right there if you're watching. And she did Widow and Utopia, which is, I think, on Amazon now. Perhaps, but you can stream Sharp Objects on Hulu, I think, and then Utopia, I think, on Amazon Prime.
Was Widows a book first? It seemed like such a movie when I saw it. I don't imagine that being a novel, but I could be completely wrong.
It could have been one of her novellas, to be honest. I'm not sure. Hang on, let's look. It might be in her little entry here. No, she doesn't have it listed here.
I was like, of all the things you listed, when I sat down and watched Widows, I feel like that only could have been a motion picture. Like, it felt like an action movie. It didn't seem like a Gillian Flynn novel to start to me, but.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see Widows, so I actually don't know what the style is. I've read Dark Places, Sharp Objects, and Gone Girl. So I haven't.
Worth watching. It's not mind-blowingly good, but it's essentially widows of this heist gone wrong, and now they're pulling off their own heist. And it's entertaining. It's not gonna, you know, rock your world, but it's worth watching.
Yeah, it looks like it wasn't a novel, so I think she produced that for that specific purpose. So that checks out. But yeah, she's great. She's a great writer. She, fun fact, part of the inspiration of this film was the time that she got laid off from Entertainment Weekly. So some of Amy's storyline she identifies with directly. I thought
you were going a totally different direction when you said inspired by in her
that
real
she
life.
Was inspired by when she tried to murder her husband. No, I'm just kidding. No, not that in this case. But her husband in this one was played by Mr. Ben Affleck, who has done a gabazillion things, as you all probably already know. He acted in Argo as well as directed it, The Town, Good Will Hunting, a number of things. Very talented guy, I think, personally. I know he gets a little bit of flack for some of his performances, but I think he does a great job here. And if you think about, we'll get into it, some of the things that this is based on, it's almost uncanny. Some of the people he's trying to emulate here in his role. So
I felt like he was emulating himself in the meme of him that would come years later where he's standing like just cigarette. Disheveled with a cigarette. He does that in this like twice, and that's years before that meme took
shape. He is wearing the same shirt though, honestly, not only from the meme, but several times in the movie. So yeah, it checks out. And then of course, Rosamund Pike, who plays Amy in this. She does an incredible job. She's been in a number of things that we've talked about. She did some ones that you may not know, though, are A Private War. I thought she did an incredible job. If you haven't seen that, it's a really good job of her as a war photojournalist. Really interesting. She also did a movie called I Care a Lot, which I'm pretty sure is also on Netflix. And she plays very much a villain in that as well, but a very different type of villain. Somebody who is responsible for the care of the elderly is what I will say. So it's an interesting one for her. And then she also was in Saltburn, which we have covered, obviously.
Which she does such a great comedic turn in that of just dry comedy that is just brilliant to watch. She's also really good in The World's End, which was one of the Cornetto trilogies by Edgar Wright with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. And that was underrated, I think. Everyone loves the first two, but she's really good in that. And The World's End is worth watching if you like Shaun of the Dead or Hot Fuzz.
I love when we have our respective picks here because yours always check out for me. You would pick The World's End. But yes, she is good in that. I actually agree. Neil Patrick Harris is also in this. He plays Desi Collins, her pseudo-stalker. He hasn't actually done as much as I feel like he's done, if that makes sense. I was like looking
to do when
for
you're
stuff.
On a TV series for what, a decade plus.
It's like the thing that you do. Yeah, it's what you're known
for. You look
for.
At George Clooney on ER. I mean, his film career he was in stuff, but I feel like it's harder to do when you have those
while you're doing that full time. Yeah. So he was, I mean, to that end, he was in How I Met Your Mother for a decade plus. He also did a series of Unfortunate Events for several years. I was not big into that series, so I didn't really watch it. I watched all of How I Met Your Mother. And then he's done a couple of film or supporting other TV roles. But he also notably has done like Broadway and plays and things like that as well. So, but yeah, from a film movie perspective, there's not as many.
I was going to say, I didn't get to call this out last week when we were talking musicals with Amelia Perez, but Dr. Horrible Sing-Along Blog, which was a YouTube original by currently canceled Joss Whedon, piece of shit, but really entertaining. Neil Patrick Harris playing like a wannabe supervillain, and they did it during the writer's strike, so I don't think anyone was paid. I think it was all on their own. It was more just like a hobby thing of let's pass the
for
time
funsies.
While we have this free time. And yeah, so it's worth looking up on YouTube if you can find it.
All right, cool, good to know. Also, Mr. Tyler Perry, who you probably know for the Madea movies. It's really, especially from an acting perspective, is mainly the only thing that he's done.
But he's like a juggernaut, right? I'm not informed enough about this, but hasn't he built a media empire at this point?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I just mean from an acting perspective, he's only done the Madea stuff primarily, but he's done a couple other ones. This is the most straight character, like straight to the camera, I mean, kind of character that I feel like he plays in this particular film. But yeah, he is the Oprah of film and TV production. He is a juggernaut in and of himself. He, fun fact, I don't know why I know this and why it's in my brain, but he is where when Meghan and Harry turned down their, you know, royal duties in England, he housed them in LA. He put them up in his house for, I think, over a year. They lived in Tyler Perry's house because he was just like, y'all, let me help you out. So he's an interesting fellow.
I'm in the spare bedroom right now.
Yeah, you know, they had a baby running around. I think that's all it was. They totally would have stayed with you. Yep. Yeah. Yep. I think you were their first choice, and then the baby situation happened. You know what I mean? Yeah. We also have Carrie Coon here, who I think is a real gem. She has done a number of things. I think she is incredibly versatile is what I would say about her, that I think she's really underrated as like a character actor who can play just about anybody, really. In this, she's a very unique character, but also she's in the most recent, like literally just dropped this week, version of White Lotus. And then she also did the new Ghostbusters with Paul Rudd and co. So both of those. And then she also plays a really interesting character whose name escapes me at this moment. I apologize, but The Gilded Age on HBO, which is based on the Gilded Age of New York City. And she was one of the new money kind of characters. She's a very strong character, but a wildly different type of character. So just those three examples, she plays really different people. I think she's really interesting.
I was going to say, you called out a couple of HBO shows. She's one of those actors, actresses that gets brought back to HBO series a lot because I loved her in The Leftovers. I thought she really carried that series from start to finish.
Yeah.
And then shout out because she's also in the last two Avengers movies as Proxima Midnight, mostly CGI digital effects, but her voice is in there as one of the Thanos' little henchmen people.
Yeah, she's really good. I think she can – I'm look forward to keep seeing her in more and more stuff of just doing, you know, various roles that are really different because she's already shown she can really do that, which is awesome. Kim Dickens is the last one I'm going to bring up unless you have others. She plays the detective here and I think she's a gem. She is so entertaining to me throughout in this whole thing. She's done a number of TV shows, but she did most recently The Good Nurse. As far as films, she hasn't done a ton of films that you would probably know, but she has done The Highwaymen with Kevin Costner, if you ever saw that, was really good.
That was one of the things in waiting so long to rewatch this is I forgot she was in it. It was so cool to see her on, you know, the big screen because I just feel like she is a TV journeywoman. She's on everything, it feels like. She has cameos on different shows. She has main roles in Fear the Walking Dead, Sons of Anarchy. She was on it every, you know, a few times every season. So just mad props to her for being a working actress and then getting a role like this. And again, she takes full advantage of her time on screen. I think she almost steals the movie in some ways. She does. It's hard to say that she overshadows the main cast, but she's a blast to watch in this.
Yeah, I would agree. I think every time she's on screen, you are paying attention. She really does kind of steal the show a little bit in those scenes. And especially when you kind of get used to his character, when he's put up against her, she's the thing you're paying attention to, I think, more often than not.
She's got a lot of that. Who's the main detective in Fargo?
Frances McDormand's character.
Yeah, her character. I forget what the detective's name is, but like she's got that no nonsense, independent female detective. That's at this point, maybe it kind of feels like an archetype, but I never get sick of it. It's great to watch.
One, I don't get sick of it, and two, I think she makes it wholly her own in this, to be honest. Like she has a very different style, and I think you don't get to know her well for a reason. But she still tells you exactly who she is, if that makes sense. Yeah. So really quick summary here. The husband of a missing woman becomes the chief suspect in her disappearance. That's it. That's the whole summary. I like it. I mean, I think it makes sense. It's to the point. Really quick production note here. This had a $61 million budget. And if the ratings weren't enough to tell you, it did pretty well. $371 million at the box office, basically. $370.9 million. So and
David Fincher's highest grossing, when the ones you named earlier, Fight Club, yeah. Seven, this was his highest grossing film, which says a lot.
I think it's, you know what I think it says personally? This is pure conjecture. I have no data to back this up, but I think it says a lot about women audiences because how, you know, people underestimate, just like Sears did back in the day, how much women spend on things and the decisions that they drive. And you saw this movie as a woman, the preview of it, and you were like, I have to see that for a million reasons, including but not limited to this cast, including Rosamund Pike, but also the fact that this is true crimey. It's a true crime story. And if you didn't already know, I'll just get it out of the way at the top. Something I want to share is that this is very loosely based on a number of things, but one of them being the Lacey and Scott Peterson case, where he is accused of having killed his wife. And she was a pregnant, soon-to-be mom when she disappeared and then was eventually found dead. And it was a really huge, like, swept the nation kind of case. And people like Nancy Grace covered it. And an Ellen Abbott, for example, are, you know, shown here as a replacement for a Nancy Grace, as a replacement for a Scott Peterson. So some of this is almost like for like a similar type of story and showing those particular scenes that were in real life to some degree from a true crime perspective.
I had heard that name sort of in the research for this, but was he found guilty? Like, is he in prison now?
I think he was. I can't remember now, but I think he was found guilty. Also, like, I have watched a number of documentaries on this, and I don't remember if he was found guilty, because to me, he is so clearly guilty. Like, I don't know if he was actually found guilty, but to me, I was like, this fucker killed his wife. But I think you're supposed to think that way about this in this context, right?
Yeah.
We get a little bit of a different view here. Obviously, we get to understand his point of view, but the perception is, well, the husband always does it.
It's always the husband.
Always the husband, which statistically is true, right? This is why this whole story works as well as it does. So
I think it's also like, with that in mind, I don't know that how many other actors this could have worked with aside from Affleck. I think he's a great casting job because if watching this for the first time, you don't know how you keep thinking there's going to be a twist of like, did he really do it? Is he out of his mind? Is there going to be some weird plot twist where it turns out he did kill her and he's just forget or he is covering up? Is he that good? And then on rewatch, to be guys, we gave the spoiler warning at the top, but on rewatch, you're just like, this guy's a fucking idiot. He's just playing every scenario out completely wrong to make everyone think that he's guilty.
Well, he's hitting all the cliched buttons and he's presented in all the cliched ways. And I agree with you on the casting. It's almost perfect, especially if you are modeling this after Scott Peterson. There are actual side-by-side photos where you're like, whoa, this is like Scott Peterson's a little bit chunkier than Affleck, but they look so similar in the way that they are presenting. But it does also call into question the way we evaluate people in these circumstances, because, you know, his wife is missing and when this starts, and we get the benefit, at least we think, right? Like, you're supposed to, as a, by and large, spoiler alert, these are both unreliable narrators. You're supposed to see him as an unreliable narrator, but you're also supposed to see her as an unreliable narrator. But she's our narrator from the top, and you don't know that. You don't know yet whether or not she is or isn't, but you see his action. And I think I love how that is overlaid, right? You get her narration where you're not sure about it yet, and then you get their action and then a little bit more focus on him and what he's doing in that action for a good portion of the film up until her disappearance. And so you don't know for sure if he didn't do it or did it, but I assume on a first watch, which it's been a while, you don't see anything about it that gives you a clue that he did either. You're not like, oh yeah, he obviously did it. There's no giving that away to start with. And yeah, those two being side by side is what I think makes this so fascinating to follow.
Yeah, that was one of the first things I wrote down, was just the storytelling framework in this makes the first mm-hmm. half really compelling, because mm-hmm. you're getting these flashback sequences of her narrating these stories. I will say, it always takes me a while to sort of fall into Fincher mode of the dialogue at the beginning is too clever. It's Gilmore Girls. No one talks like this. And just their banter, that rubs me the wrong way.
Some of us talk like this.
Yeah, you sure? Are you sure about that?
That I love party, this shit. I'm just like, I love
this. This is like, it just feels so phony. And then by 20 minutes into the movie, I'm settled in, and then it becomes more yeah. realistic. And maybe this is because it's so a product smart. Of memory. That's how she recalls it in her diary of like, he was this perfect guy and he did all these things.
Well, let's pause there because I'm curious, like, how many things like that do you feel like you remember that way, in that romantic way? You know what I mean? Like,
I always think I'm super clever. I get home from a party and I'm like, Lamar, you really nailed it tonight. Even if no yeah. one laughed at any of my jokes. So,
which I doubt happened, to be fair. It
rarely does, honestly.
Lamar is a straight up stand-up comic, is what y'all didn't get there. But I just feel like I resonate so much with, not necessarily like the witty repartee down to the letter, right? Like, we get this recounting of their actual dialogue that is, to your point, so intelligent and fast and all of these things. It's Gilmore Girls and it's all those things. But I do think it's easy to look back on a romantic interlude or a first meeting or a whatever and go like, oh, I was on fire there. You know what I mean? Like, I was just like, we were having a vibe, or I was on fire, or this was hilarious, or we had a really good rapport and this went great. And maybe romanticize it a little bit more than is actual.
Rose tinted glasses. Yeah, yeah. I hear that.
Yeah.
But I love that framework for that first 30 minutes where you're not entirely sure yet what's going on.
Yeah.
And just having him in present day going through these terrible things, but then backtracking to how they're related, walking through how we got here. I
the
just
origin
love that.
Story. Yeah. Yep. I think the back and forth, I agree. I love how that's structured. I love the narration versus the present day structure. I do also really like that you are invested in them at the top end. And you want it to work out, and you think she seems great, you think he seems great. And I love that the callback to that later, right? Of when a switch flips and you're supposed to see it from a different lens, you now understand how you started this way and why the story was being told this way. And like, I think this particular screenplay, which is a credit to Gillian Flynn, as we said, is such a great representation of how to really tell a story and really tie it together. And for me, there's no loose ends, right? Like, you're looking for them, I think, kind of throughout, and you don't really find them, but everything sort of complements each other in that way.
Yeah, that turn, I think, I want to say that happens maybe 40 minutes into the film or so, when we find out Amy is mm-hmm. alive. And we mm-hmm. get her sort of like, yeah, villain origin story, her monologue, which
her
takes
villain
up probably
origin story. I love that, because I think, like, it's so true. Yeah.
That 6-minute monologue she delivers, where she walks us through her entire
the
plan.
Cool girl monologue.
Oh, yeah.
Man.
It just nails it. And that is just such a great moment in the film, because it's like, okay, I can relax a little bit because I now know what happened to this missing person. I know this guy who we're kind of sympathizing with, but kind of suspicious. Like, we sort of know everything that's going on. And to have her walk through how it's going to play out, now it becomes more of a cat and mouse game, as opposed to what we were dealing with of the stress of the first 40 minutes.
Yeah, it's in the book, and I wish I could remember where it is. Maybe I can find it while we're talking. But the monologue pretty much follows the source material of mm-hmm. her going off about how she got here, right? And I feel like you sort of sympathize. There's a lot of things happening here, first of all. Like, it's very easy to, one, assume the husband did it, murdered his wife because he wanted this new hot piece of ass. That's one thing that we're dealing with, which is completely stereotypical, but also believable. Secondarily, you have a woman who has snapped, because her husband has, you know, they've had this relationship together. They've built their life together. She has given him everything. And then he cheats on her. And you get this woman who becomes, to your point, has her villain origin story because of this man. Also totally believable.
I want to correct, though, not you, but both of us, because I said villain origin story, and we later find out, like, she's kind of done this before, not to this capacity, but we have multiple instances of, oh, she's kind of fucked up. Like, we see her crazy. We know Nick is no angel, and he's also a piece of shit. But it's cool to see them play off each other as the film goes on, of just outdoing each other in how bad of a person we could potentially be in this scenario.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good call out, because she's had the vestiges of this to date, I think fair to say, right? She's been building this persona in a number of ways. But then the last one I wanted to call out is the way that we as society can stereotype women, and it can go one of two ways and there is no in between, right? She is the angelic, perfect, pregnant, submissive, accomplished, beautiful, submissive wife. She is virginal. She is perfection incarnate. She is the perfect daughter. She is blonde-haired, blue-eyed, perfect skin. She is all the things, right? That is one option. Or she's this person that we get to see behind the curtain of psychopath who is seeking her vengeance on everyone who has ever betrayed her. Her parents have used her. Her husband has abused her, not physically, but emotionally. And she has never been given her due because she is brilliant and misunderstood and all the things. And so she snaps and she's crazy. So we have many stereotypes to deal with here.
You said two types of women, and the first one had all these descriptors, and the second one, when you said psychopath, I was like, that pretty much nails it, because any guy who doesn't like a girl is like, she's crazy. That's the word, right?
That's the first thing you tell your guy friends, of like, she's crazy. I mean, and like, I had, and I was, okay, so here's the thing that Rosamund Pike says about this character that I really love, is she gets interviewed about this later, and she's like, listen, every single woman I know has tried this on before, this cool girl persona, right? Do you keep it? Maybe not. Do you love it? Maybe not. Sometimes you do, right? But every single woman I know has tried this on at some point, to bond with people, to foster relationships, to get a better job, to like whatever it is. You want to see how you feel about that reality. And I am certainly not immune to that. I have done that and felt that before. And I remember a number of situations where this applies, but I had one particular guy friend who we used to joke back and forth of, he was the male version of me and I was the female version of him. And he would talk so much shit about women. And he would just talk about how I was unique, I was different, I was whatever. And we were not romantically involved, but he was like, well, not like you, but she was crazy. Not like you, but this girl was a psycho. Like, these kinds of comments were very, very normal. And I normalized them. And I thought, yeah, she must be crazy because he's so chill and he's so like me and blah, blah, blah. And then sure enough, this fucker is like, hey, I like you.
Thank you for getting me there, because I didn't want to interrupt your story, but I was like, he had feelings for you, right?
Okay. Right. So he comes back around and is like, oh my God, you're the perfect girl. You're the, you know, whatever, this person that she monologues about, that he has decided that I am, because I'm cool with him and I let him say things or do things that other people wouldn't. And it's like, no, just because I let you behave that way doesn't mean that that applies to me. And it doesn't mean that I'm not a woman, or that I don't have certain thoughts or feelings or what have you. I just love that whole speech, because at various points in your life, you either really can see it and identify with it as something that you either have done or doing, or you can really demonize it as this really horrible dynamic between men and women, and how inauthentic it is.
I 100% agree with everything you just said. The only thing that I would add on the positive side, this is the point in the movie where you are allowed to laugh. Because even though this is very, very dark, now that you know everyone involved is safe for now, and we know this is a fucked up situation and a fucked up relationship, I feel like then the script is able to lean more into the comedy of, you're seeing these like bad things happening to bad people, and you're allowed to sort of deep breath of relief, but also laugh going forward.
Yeah, I think it's, I think it makes a lot of things funnier that are otherwise not funny. I will say they lend themselves to some absurdities here as well, right? Yeah. So as she's giving this fucking monologue, she has gained 10 pounds. And what I need y'all to understand is that the total days gone for this woman is 30 days, right? 30 total days. That is, plug your ears if you're squeamish. Also, I'm joking because deal with it. That's one menstrual cycle, right? So that's one menstrual cycle, 30 days. She has traveled. She has framed her own death. And she has somehow gained and lost in the span of 30 days, 10, 20 pounds. And when she's giving the cool girl monologue, she's eating Kit Kats and like eating a burger, I think it is.
God, I wanted a burger after watching this movie.
I wanted a burger so bad while she was eating that burger. I was like, that looks delicious. Yeah. But she has dyed her hair this dark mousy color. She's wearing horrible clothes that are not flattering. She's in this terrible car and she's just eating for days like she's never eaten in her life. And it's supposed to be this very clear and stark juxtaposition against her, you know, thin, together, beautiful self that was perfection incarnate, all the things that we just said, but is also unrealistic. Like, she did not gain 10 pounds in 2 days of eating burgers. You know what I mean? But it is intended to add color to this like absurdity and this whole monologue. But there, that was something and still continues to be something, despite how many times that I have watched this film, that distracts me every time, that bothers me every time, of like, she did not gain this much weight and then immediately lose this much weight being at this one, you know, nice house that Neil Patrick Harris puts her in later for a hot minute, and she immediately drops all the weight. That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
At least Affleck had an excuse, because I think he was doing, what was it, Batman versus Superman at this time? So he gets like, not flabby, I'm not going to call it flabby, but he gets like looser versus being super toned and jacked back and forth through this movie. But I think that's Batman's to blame.
I think Batman's a little bit to blame. I think middle age is a little bit to blame. But I remember when they like make him take his shirt off later. And there's two very prominent things that happen in that scene. There's the shirt and there's a little flashy poo. And the thing that distracts me more is his pecs, or should I say boobs? I don't know. But it's like, yeah. So the visuals here and people's bodies here are on display for a reason, mm-hmm. is what I would say as well. Like, they want you to feel her weight gain. They want you to feel his middle-agedness. They want you to see and notice all of that. They don't shy away from it from a shot perspective.
To tie that back to something that I mentioned near the start is, again, I think Affleck is such a great choice for this, because do you remember the first time you saw this? Were you thinking from the outset, oh, he killed her? Or did you think it was going to go in a different direction?
I really couldn't honestly answer that. Okay. You know, it's been so long that I don't know. I saw it in theaters when it came out, and I can't remember if I thought that. Also, I had read the book, and I can't I have read the book, and I can't remember if I read it before or after. If I had read it before, then I certainly knew. Yeah, I just can't remember. It's been so long.
The reason I say that and the reason I ask is because
I think it changes the experience for sure.
There were three names that I came across in sort of what if casting of these folks were almost put into this role. And I'm going to read them to you from most realistic to, I think, most ridiculous of what would have completely changed your view of the film when the first time you were watching this. Number one is John Hamm, who I think, you could put John Hamm in this role in it, but he couldn't get out of Mad Men, apparently. You could put him in here and I would buy, like, okay, this could be that he is guilty. It could also be he's totally flabbergasted mm-hmm. by this and sort of actually looking for his wife. The second was Ryan Reynolds, which I think if I were watching that film, I would assume, well, he's innocent. He's a good guy, right? Like, no way he could have done anything. And then the third one, which I was just like, really? He was considered, was Seth Rogen. I don't know what you do with Seth Rogen in this role.
Y'all, I was reaching for something really quick, and then Lamar said that, and I was like, I'm sorry, what?
apparently was considered in pre-production as one of the top two or three candidates for this role, and I don't know that I would have bought that in any capacity.
I do not understand that. That is wild to me. That's a weird one. And I'm not saying, like, you couldn't make very different types win, but that didn't really... That one doesn't resonate.
I just think Affleck nails, or not even that he nails it. He just looks the type where there's a line of dialogue in the film where he's kind of getting fawned over, and it's that serial killer mentality where people are like, mm-hmm. oh, like, this guy's so hot, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, we don't know if he did it or not, but a girl says he is so hot, and then her friend goes, he is so creepy. That, I think, Affleck, it's the right casting for that line of dialogue specifically, I think. He could go either way.
I do think that's accurate. I do think that's pretty, you know, because, well, yeah, everybody sees a tall, generically handsome white guy with different eyes, right? Mm-hmm. Like, to whomever they are, it's either the perfect man or... Yeah, could be total creep. I think that's really interesting. And I agree. I think he's a perfect casting. Again, I encourage you to look up side-by-side Gone Girl pictures of all the things, including but not limited to Affleck next to Scott Peterson. It's, again, he's a little chunkier, but like the gestures, the facial expressions, the interview photos that you see show up here, they're all very comparable. And I think he does a great job in the sense that there are things that he does that you're like, why would you react that way? Why would you say that way? That's makes you look bad. That happened in real life with Scott Peterson. But this upends that because, of course, again, as we find out, he didn't do it. And you go, oh, well, should I question that? Should I question the way people deal with trauma? Everybody deals with trauma differently, and people don't know how to talk to cops and all these kinds of things. And I think like this, all these interactions are supposed to make you feel that way. What I love about Kim Dickinson's character that I don't want to overlook is that she is the one who gives him the fairest shake top to bottom.
Yeah.
She doesn't assume that he's guilty. She buys into what is perceived to be his genuine concern when he gets home and finds the situation that he finds. And she asks him questions very reasonably, but with an edge of like, let me see. It's not aggressive. It's not like police misconduct, right? She's not manipulating him, but she says things here and there to like, just test the waters, like see how he reacts. And a lot of it makes sense. A lot of it you could relate to as a person. Like the blood type scene is one of my favorites where he's like, you know, she's like, you don't know your wife's blood type. You don't know her best friend. You don't know what she does all day. Okay. And then she sends him out of the room to call her or his in-laws or whatever. And I love that the other investigator turns to her and she's like, should I know my wife's blood type? And she's like, no. Like, you know,
that's what I love about that character and Kim Dickens' portrayal of her is she is just so much smarter. She plays up sort of this, I don't even know what the adjective is I'm looking for, but she's not hokey, but she plays up the fact that she is a female police officer. And yeah. She's not letting people take advantage of her, but she's sort of laying low and waiting for them to make a mistake. So she is so much smarter than everyone around her. And to the point of just like she has a better read on the situation than anyone, because everyone else honestly is, at least in the police department, is assuming that it's the husband. But she's waiting for evidence. She's waiting for things to clear up.
Which again, I think is speaking to how much smarter than everyone she is.
Yeah.
And how much she is not just not to disparage your term here, but just to upend the perception of just a female cop, right? Like in so many roles, people would be like, women are emotional, women jump to conclusions, all these bullshit stereotypes. Meanwhile, she's the only person waiting for evidence, waiting for scientific proof of anybody's guilt, including his. And so she gives him a very fair shake, and it does start to feel overwhelming. And I give her all the credit in the world for when that happens, right? Of like, you have to look at it from her perspective of, this, the game has changed, my guy. This is at your sister's house. This thing has happened. You've had an affair. Like, I have tried and I have tried to give you the benefit of the doubt. And I got news for you, kid. You look real bad on paper. And I love that for her of being like, hey, no, you don't get to act like I haven't been fair to you. I have been so fair to you. And I do. I think she has been as neutral as you can be in these contexts. But I, like you said, she really holds her own, not only with him, but with everyone around her. And there's one situation where her just being neutral, people assume that she is in favor of him. And her counterpart, her investigator counterpart is like, oh, you got a crush? That scene is one of my favorite fucking scenes because she's like, number one, don't talk to me like that ever. Number two, and she explains to him why he's so wrong, right? And I just love that she calm, cool, collects, sets the standard for the way that she's going to be treated and spoken to and her professionalism, and then also goes into why she is just running an investigation. And that's the thing that she says. She's like, number one, I am conducting an investigation and not a witch hunt. And it just, you can't help but respect her. She's so fucking cool.
Yeah. She is, like I said, carries a lot of this feel. Every time she, you said it, every time she's on screen, you are enthralled by her and the way that she's sort of handling the scenario. And I mean, it plays out at the end too. We're not jumping too far ahead, but when the FBI shows up and they're sort of, she knows. So I love throughout the film, she knows something is off. Like, granted, yes, eventually she does sort of become
but
convinced.
But she can't figure it out. Yeah.
Right. She gets convinced by Amy's evidence eventually, but she always knows something is off. She's like, why is this diary just kind of burned? That seems silly. Yeah. Like, it just feels too convenient for her. And I like that she alludes to that, even though eventually it's like, well, the evidence is all there. I think part of it is also just because Nick, like I said earlier, is playing every scenario wrong. He is, you know, obviously he has cheated on his wife, but is still seeing the girl, sleeps with her. And we haven't even touched base on Margot yet and how much I fucking love Margot. But like, does it while Margot's under the same roof, like has sex with his like mistress or whatever. It just,
would we call her a mistress or would we call her a child? Because
that's it's stereotypical, but that's why it's a stereotype, because it happens sometimes, right?
But I agree. Like, I think she does. And I just one last nugget before we switch gears a little bit. But I also love where later her, again, her counterpart investigator is like, well, my wife says that he's a killer. And she's like, well, if Tiffany says, like, and I just love, I love the name choice. I love her delivery. I love everything about that scene. She just, again, she steals the show and I love it. But switching gears to, you know, again, what the overarching theme here is that you don't know, you don't know, you don't know if he did it. Maybe he did it, maybe he didn't. And then there's a pivotal shift in the way that the narration goes of all of a sudden you get Amy's perspective. And it's not just Amy's narration that we've already had. It's her shift of what has actually been happening. But again, from her point of view, right? The unreliable narrator, but the crux, the pivotal point remains the same. She caught him cheating. And for someone like her, that is unacceptable for a number of reasons, but she can't allow that this person would seek this, to be fair, child by comparison to her and her accomplishments, her intelligence, all these things, right? This is a young girl who may grow up to be incredible. Like, nobody's saying she's not, right? But right now, she is somebody that he is seeking physical affection from, and that's it, right? Like, that's the perception in this moment. But she is upended by that. She is like, how can that be the only thing that you want? How can that be the thing you betray me for? Even though it is so stereotypical, it really sends her to a bit of a breaking point that I think is interesting and surprising for somebody like her, where you would think she would have predicted this exactly, but I think that's the point of her narration, right? Of how unreliable it is, of she probably did see this coming. She probably knew exactly what was happening, you know?
Well, first off, I want to point out that from a legal lens, This is not a child. She was in that Robin Thicke Blurred Lines music video. We all saw it on YouTube. So it's not, she's much younger than Ben Affleck, but
you can acknowledge that you think she's just hot and she's allowed to do this. That's fine. She's super hot. Speaking,
she's allowed to do whatever. Emily Ratajkowski,
I wouldn't even attempt it, but yes, that beautiful woman.
Very attractive. But what I like about the monologue, you have sympathy for where Amy is coming from, if this is fucked up. But they also paint her in some ways as the villain when she says, I forged the man of my dreams. Mm-hmm. She admits to kind of manipulating him and molding him into this other person, which plays out in the ending when she says, you're the best version of yourself because of me. So you see it come kind of full circle. But I like that the monologue doesn't make her the hero of the story. It kind of relies on your own moral compass of, do you like one of these characters? Do you like both? Do you hate both?
And I think that's what's so interesting about the book. So I found the monologue in the book. But what I think is so interesting about the book is exactly that. It actually gives you a little bit more of both sides of that, of course, because it's the book. But again, she does a very good job of capturing this in the screenplay. I really believe that. But I like that she gives you more about why Amy is the way that she is. And she gives you a little bit more of that story about the monologue. And where it ends is a little bit different than in the film. And I like where she's like talking about women as window dressing. There's a touch of that. But she also says, like, how do you know you're not cool girl? Because he says things like, I like strong women. If he says that to you, he will at some point fuck someone else. Because I like strong women is code for I hate strong women. And I think that so resonates for Amy, the character, as well as a number of women. A lot of people would just agree with that to begin with. But I think it complements this story and this character so much of he loves her as an ideal. He doesn't love her as an actuality, right? And it's kind of like, and it's double tapped on with that other guy that shows up later where he goes and interviews him and says, hey, what did she accuse you of? Like, what happened with you? And that interaction is so great and so well done for a number of reasons. But one of the things he says is like, I knew this wasn't going to be easy, was one of his emphasis, right? Amy is never going to be easy for anybody that interacts with her or has a relationship with her in any capacity. She's not trying to be easy. She expects you to know that, right? And he figures that out, that she's not just cool girl. She's hard. She has high expectations. She has all these things. And that's the same cycle that Nick went through as well, of understanding that about her too. And she's a lot harder than I think anybody thinks she is. And I'll just read one more quote from the book that I think is so interesting, because she's talking about how she was born. She's an only child, if you didn't already remember that from the movie. But she said something really interesting. This is post-birth, she's born, right? She's explaining her birth. When I remained alive, they named me Amy because it was a regular girl's name, a popular girl's name, a name 1,000 other baby girls were given that year. So maybe the gods wouldn't notice this little baby nestled among the others. Mary Beth said if she were to do it again, she'd name me Lydia. I grew up feeling special, proud. I was the girl who battled oblivion and won. The chances were about 1%, but I did it. I ruined my mother's womb in the process. My own prenatal Sherman's March. Sherman's March, she references, y'all. Mary Beth would never have another baby. As a child, I got a vibrant pleasure out of this. Just me, only me.
Amy's a little fucked up.
Right? Yeah. I needed to share that with y'all. Like, this bitch started out this way is what I'm trying to get y'all to understand. From a child, like you said, she had the vestiges of this earlier in other relationships, and as a child, she was all about Amy.
Well, it's a perfect pivot from that, because I wanted to touch base on the dynamic between Nick and Margot, who are twins. And I just think that their relationship throughout the film, and again, like from birth, they have just, it seems like, been super close. They have sort of this, and unabashed trust in each other and faith in the other one to know what they're doing is right. They're protecting each other. Margot calls him out on his bullshit. And I think Margot, similar to Detective Boney, just has her finger on the pulse of the situation. Yeah. Not just like, I guess it's a little different, but she just has her finger on the optics of the situation. And I love how she's trying to give him advice and, again, calls him out when he's being a fucking idiot, which is a lot of the film.
Which is a lot of the film. And I love that it doesn't change their dynamic for her, though. That's still her brother. That's still her twin. That's something that gets referenced a lot, too, is their dynamic, even by the talk show host, who, like I said, is very Nancy Grace-esque. And there's a running joke on a podcast that I listen to about how the Scott Peterson case is the case that broke Nancy Grace. Because prior to that, she was actually pretty even keel and would just report the news of these types of cases. She was a lawyer. She knew what she was talking about. But the absurdity of this case sort of turned her into the like shrieking, crazy person that she, and I say that intentionally, y'all, that she has since become in so many of her segments, either for ratings or because she really believes it, whatever it is. And so that is really shown here over and over again. And on that segment, they talk about Go and him and their dynamic. And they even imply some kind of incestuous relationship between the two of them, which feels really gross. Don't get me wrong. But I will say, I think that the closeness of their dynamic in the film is intentionally awkward at certain points or a little bit. I think you're supposed to question it. I think you're supposed to feel a little uncomfortable with it, right? Of should they be as close as they are without any question marks, so on and so forth early on. And then the thing that balances that, I think, for the viewer, for the audience, is Go calling him out repeatedly. Like the, you know, he hooks up with the girl in the house and she's like, you fucking idiot. And I love it that she's there. She's awake and she just tells him straight up. And then also her telling him like, you look bad. This is making you look bad. Don't behave this way. This is like, so I like that they juxtapose the two because otherwise I don't think you would have that balance. I think you would have the exact same thoughts, concerns, awkwardness that Ellen Abbott implies if you didn't get those other moments from Go.
Yeah. First off, thank you for bringing up the twincest conversation because I think that's the second Game of Thrones reference this episode. Cersei Lannister, second Cersei reference this episode.
I know. But honestly.
But the script is so well put together on this. Again, shout out to the author of the book who just made this make sense because I think that's a great point that I hadn't thought of. Without Margot there, you're left to your own devices. But having this voice of reason in the script makes it kind of make sense to you. And it's like, why are you doing, if you're innocent, why are you doing all these stupid, why are you smiling by the missing poster? Why are you still cheating on your missing wife? It's just a lot of bullshit that she calls out on his behalf.
I like that there's multiple comments from that, though, across the board that I do appreciate and I sort of understand of him smiling at the missing poster or somebody asking to take a picture with him, him helping the homeless man or, you know, trying to get him some food. Rather, you don't really know what's going on there, but you're trying to get this man food who clearly is at this thing to get some food. I think those are genuinely endearing things about him, actually, at a few times, but they are subjected to this very different lens. And I think that's the point, right? Of the lens is it doesn't change the fact that your wife is missing and you don't know what happened to her. So how can you act normal and help the random guy looking for food and take the selfie with the woman and blah, 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 blah. But the one caveat that I will give is that one, everybody responds to trauma differently. And two, how would you cope in that situation? Would you be trying to just have some sense of normalcy of like, I still at a baseline am the person that I am and I move through the world the way that I do and I act the way that I do? And do I put on this maudlin character for all of you so that you believe how sad I am? Or do I just keep acting the way that I am because I'm actually innocent of this thing?
Well, to that point, Amy calls it out when she sees him on TV standing next to the missing poster. And she says, give me that smile. Give me that Nick smile. Mm-hmm. It's, she knows that's who he is. So this is just how he's reacting. He's not intending to seem happy next to it. I think that was a conscious decision. I believe David Fincher cast Affleck in this because he had seen him doing some like, oh, we're on the red carpet. Give a big smile, Ben. And he gave this half-assed fake smile. And that's what you see in the film. So that kind of, again, led to Affleck being the perfect casting choice here. I wanted to cut real quick to one thing that I don't love about the movie. It's like the one
How
thing-
How very dare you? No, I'm
I know,
just kidding.
I'm sorry. What? But one thing that, I know it's a motion picture and I should just like buy into everything. But in that middle section, when we go from, we find out that Amy is on the lam. We find out she's orchestrated this whole thing. Then we're sort of in this, her playing puppeteer, puppet master from a distance. Mm-hmm. There's a couple coincidences that happen at that point in the film. I wrote down, thank God for these two Ozark hicks who rob her and send her off on this path to getting us to our conclusion of the film. But it's that coupled with when Nick is finally going to confess that he had an affair and sort of come clean, you know, Andy goes on the news and it's Andy, right?
Yes, it is Andy. The Mennonite, Andy.
And he confesses like 2 minutes before he was supposed to do his interview. Like there's three different little coincidences in this little 15-minute span that gets us to the final act. I don't love all three of those having to sort of connect because they feel kind of out of nowhere that they're happening. It makes me feel good to see that Amy gets a little bit of comeuppance of like, you can't manipulate every situation, dumbass.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, I think the thing that's interesting about that is, well, there's a couple things. One, again, I think this touches on reality a little bit of, and Tanner Bolt tells her that he, you know, she's going to confess. Like she will 100% confess. This is something they do every time. And while I think that is true for a number of reasons, and it follows a lot of patterns, in the case of the Scott Peterson case, she ends up being a real hero, the woman that outs Scott Peterson, because she genuinely, this is not at all the same scenario. She was not a student. She didn't know he was married. He was coming to a whole other town. She had no idea who he was, blah, 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 blah. And she acts almost immediately as a spy to try and record him and catch him lying about his wife, because he told her that his wife was dead before she was ever dead, for example. So it's an interesting representation of that, because here it's the kind of the cliche, it's the stereotype, it's the, oh, it's the young student, it's the typical affair, and she's just, you know, she's just trying to get her 15 minutes and all this bullshit. Versus in the real life comparison, this person was trying to help, actually. Mm-hmm. And, but I think it's intentional. I think it's really interesting how it's different, because it is very, it follows tropes. It follows all the tropes that it can follow. And then it upends the one that is the crux of the matter, which is, did he do it? And he didn't. And I think we have to spend a quick minute there of, goes through all this stuff. She has this situation with these hicks in the Ozarks, which is terrible. And it also upends how intelligent and smart she thinks she is, because she has all these book smarts, planning smarts, intelligence at a baseline, but not street smarts. She's not careful enough. She doesn't read the room appropriately. And so that gets the better of her. And she has to go find this whole other route with this person who she also hates, but then handily manipulates and frames for a different crime.
Which that, dude, here's my big question. That middle section that I was kind of complaining about is these two Ozarkians, I think that's what they like to be called, take all of her money and basically say, we know who you are. If you call the police, we're going to out you and your husband's going to know you're alive. Like, I don't know if they say that outright or if they just say, we know you're lying about a bunch of bullshit, but
they feel a lot more aware than I would think, but yeah.
That, but also, is Amy not crazy enough to just mastermind a murder operation against them to get her money back and then flee? Like, I don't understand why she's crazy enough to kill Neil Patrick Harris and frame him for all these terrible things, but these people who actually wronged her, she's not willing to do that.
Well, I think the implication is that they're all leaving, right? So, like, they're at this, like, seasonal resort camp type of place, and everybody's planning to leave. So, like, that's how that scene opens, too. If she's cleaning out her cabin, they're probably cleaning out her cabin. So, I think I agree with you that there's, like, some ways that she could maybe have handled this or tried to pursue this a little bit more publicly, especially of, like, even if I just go screaming out of this cabin, something will maybe happen. But I think the implication is that they are all leaving and departing this place that is all very temporary, and she has very little recourse to follow them and do anything about it.
Got it. Well, I'm just glad that she got to play mini golf at least, because this movie needed a little bit of levity.
Putt-Putt is so fun. Yeah. Putt-Putt is so fun. Even if you're bad at it, that's the whole point of it. It's a good time.
Now,
even if you drop your wad of bills and somebody robs you afterward.
Why did she have all her cash with her at the mini golf course?
Anyway. We're talking street smarts versus intellectual smarts. And she doesn't have both. And I think that's actually a great lens to see Amy with, right? Because to date, like, even in New York and all these other contexts, she has been relentlessly perfect and graceful and all the things. The way she Rosamund Pike gave an interview about this, of like the way she gets in the car is calculated. She can't just plop into the car. She holds everything. She has grace. She has intentionality about everything. And so it's nice to see her have moments where she didn't read it right.
Right.
And she wasn't prepared and she didn't know what to do. And that's what throws her into the arms of this person that she doesn't want to have to deal with. But now she does.
Yeah. So segueing from there, I have two questions. Number one is, was Neil Patrick Harris the right choice for this role? We know where he was as far as television is concerned. And it has nothing to do with his sexuality. By this point, he was out. So I'm not saying, like, he can play straight. He obviously had on television for many years. No. Not about that, but more about just this character of he's kind of like, he's well-meaning, but he's also kind of creepy. Like, does he pull that off for you is the first part of my question.
Yes. Okay. I think he does pull that off. Yes. I don't just like, could somebody have done it better? Probably. I do agree with that of like, maybe he wasn't their first choice, but mostly because of the dynamic between him and her is what I would say. He, independent of her, I think can pull that off, that premise off, right? Of I am an attractive cis male who is wealthy, but also controlling and does da da da. Yep. Check, check, check. That all works. I think it's more the complement of each other that maybe doesn't quite work, in that it's hard to buy that he and her specifically, that dynamic ever really had anything. But I do think he pulls off the creep factor really well. I mean, and he does it in really subtle ways that I think are like, he wants the Amy that is perfect, right? The version that he has idolized for years. She is not allowed to eat too much, right? Which we've established she's already lost 15 pounds in 2 days. So that's incredible. But how very dare she eat the dessert and also eat his dessert, like no creme brulee for you. And he takes it away. Like, there are so many small controlling behaviors here that I don't even know if everybody notices. Hopefully they do.
I don't think I picked up on that the second time through even. So I hear you.
Turns off the cameras, buys her the clothes. He tells her to cut her hair. Buys her hair dye. He doesn't want her to watch TV for too long. Turns that off. He doesn't want her to eat. Cause like, listen, bitch has discovered dessert in her freedom from Nick. And listen, if I agree with anything, have a great time, right? And she goes for the second creme brulee and he takes it out of her hands and removes it and turns off the Sharon special.
So maybe I misread that, because I thought that was just her continuing to eat because she was so hyper-focused on Nick's news story. And so he was like, I'm turning off the story about your husband and I'm taking your sweet treat. But I think the truth could be both or neither of these, but yeah, maybe I misread that.
I think
that.
It can be a combo. The way I saw it was like, she's eating all of hers, which is normal portion, whatever. She's eating all of hers, but she is eating it like kind of incessantly, aggressively, like whatever. She's really entranced, like you said, in the show. She puts it down, but there's a solid beat between mm-hmm. that and her going for the other one. And the other one is his. Right. So like he's aware of it and he hops up, turns off the show, grabs her dessert. Da, da, da. He has a thing about rules, parameters, structure. Obviously, he's a bit OCD. He's super controlling. And it also felt like she didn't look like herself, meaning she wasn't hot, skinny, all the things. And so I think food control is part of that. And he's a really controlling person. So yeah. I think he leaned into that well, I think, as an actor.
Maybe it's just, maybe it was just my experience of seeing him on How I Met Your Mother, where he is this charmer and he's kind of got a creep factor to it for sure as Barney Stinson on that.
He was such a fucking bro on that. Like, yeah. Let's be honest. Yeah.
So to see him in this, where he seems very uncertain of himself, but then like you said, he does eventually turn it on where it's like, oh, this is a control freak. Also weirdo. So I'm with you.
I think he's uncertain of himself in relation to her. She always made him feel inadequate, yeah. Right? Because he wasn't for her and he was obsessed with her. I think he's always been maybe overly confident, actually, about himself, his success, his knowledge, da, 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 da. But this is the one person he hasn't been able to win over. And now he's in a position to control her because she's indebted to him. And I think he's leaning into that. And don't get me wrong, I think he manipulates and does that with other people probably. But I think this is a real sense of victory for this person.
I think you can equate sense of victory and leaning in with his death scene, because he's got a sense of victory. He's climaxing.
Yeah.
He's yep. leaning in maybe a little too close yep. because then he gets close. That death scene is fucking brutal. I forgot.
It is so fucked up. It is yeah. so fucked up. And it's so, but it is so well done. But yeah. like the fact that, like, not to get crass, like, I don't know, grandma's plug your ears, whatever. But like, she is still fucking him. And I say, use that word judiciously while she is murdering him, right? Like, she wants the evidence of that physicality. Having murdered him and sliced his literal throat, and there is blood literally spewing everywhere.
And just the way it's shot with the blood pouring down, yep. the fade in, fade out of like the yep. dark to the scene, the different angles. I forgot completely about that, because most of them, you mentioned David Fincher's sort of style earlier, and I think his style is the lighting is a little obvious, but for the way he frames right. shots, it's nothing spectacular. That's not to say it's not good, but it's pretty by the books. This is the one thing where I'm like, oh, that feels Finchery. Like, that feels that like something from Seven shot. When you're watching it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think also, like, this is very minute, but something I notice every time is that there's blood everywhere, but her hair is perfect.
Yeah.
Her face yeah. is perfect. Even afterward, when she's trying to retain the evidence, by the way, she keeps grabbing her vagina and holding it to keep everything in, right? She has a rough arm that has a little bit of blood on it, but she has this moment of like she's coming down from having done this. This gives her some sort of thrill, for lack of a better term. And she wipes her face and you expect it to smear with blood. And it doesn't. It's the one clean spot on her arm. And to me, it's so eerie. It contributes to the eeriness of the scene for me of like, there should in theory be mess and blood everywhere to an uncontrollable degree in her hair, on her arms, on everything. And there's not. She knows exactly where the blood is. She knows exactly where to wipe herself. And it's so, like I said, it's just eerie.
That's a great word for it. So let's move. We've done away with all the three first name cast members. Neil Patrick Harris is gone. Let's move to the conclusion of this, where I think it starts with Amy sort of making her way home. And how do you feel about the way that we conclude here of them both being, we sort of glossed over him doing the interview and saying, come home, baby, like I miss you, blah, blah, being bullshitting her the same way she bullshits him. But how do you feel about the way that this plays out with her wandering back in this sort of unstable alliance they have going?
I feel very, very Tanner Bolt in this moment because I feel like he's like, you gotta have a begrudging respect for your wife at this point, you know? And like, that's it for me, right? It was like, she is a fucking crazy person and she has literally killed for him at this point, which she does not hesitate to point out. But she's this dominant force and she comes in with control of the situation, even having been removed from the situation. And the only person who can see through her is the detective that we have, again, since learned, but the only person with a fresh set of eyes, with a fresh lens. And now that she comes back, she goes, well, it's clicking mostly into place for her. Of this was a setup. And so she has a very different lens when she's asking her questions, when she's interviewing her. But again, Amy is so good at deftly maneuvering the marketing of that conversation. Of
playing to all the men in the room. Yeah.
To play all the men in the room, play everybody in the room. And now this detective woman, who is maybe the other most intelligent person in the room, because they see each other, right? This woman is now, she's the difficult woman. And Amy is the angel, right? Amy is the victim. Amy is the person who's been through all these things. She plays every single fucking person like a fiddle. And the only person who doesn't want to be played like a fiddle is Kim. And so that's fascinating to me. And it's very well played. It's devastating as an ending.
Yeah.
It's a devastating ending because she has, as far as you can tell, thought of all the outcomes. You know, she has truly, and again, we're coming back to these female-based tropes that we hate. She has truly trapped this man. She has said, I have your baby. I did this. I did that. There's nothing. I need you to prove. I need you to admit to this, this, and this for me to feel safe. She has all the power, which if you're a woman, sounds great on paper, but in this context is terrible, right? You're like, this person having all the power is a horror show. And this man is truly trapped. And you can't help but imagine the crazy life that will then ensue from this person raising a child. That is extra horrifying.
Yeah, that puts an extra spin on the ending, sort of. It's not really a monologue, but Affleck's last line where he talks about, like, what have we done? What will we do? And it sort of mirrors the beginning, the opening, when he's talking about, whenever I see my wife, I want to bash her head. And you're like, what? Where is that coming from? And then at the end, it makes total sense of we're in this unstable, again, alliance. Yeah. Just there's so much in that last 10 minutes that really lands for me. Just the initial when she stumbles up covered in blood and falls into his arms very dramatically. And he says, you fucking bitch. She does the little dip and he's holding her up. It's just all for the cameras. Her face in the police cruiser looking at all her followers and being like smiling almost of like, look at all the admiration.
And
I've
she
got.
Hasn't washed the blood off in the hospital and she comes back to the door and she's getting let in by her husband and oh, so sweet, her husband. Now he's an angel. Again, this is shown by Ellen Abbott later who comes in and he calls her out, which I love of all the things she said about him, but she's Team Nick again, right? Yeah. And there again, the marketing of it all and the how can I sell this of it all and how good Amy is at that of manipulating everything and everyone in the room.
Yeah, she's got to keep that blood on herself because we have to get that awesome shower scene. Fucking bonkers of just the blood going down the drain while they're having this, like washing this situation off of themselves. Of here's everything out in the open. Like, how are we going to make this work? And you have these moments of unease throughout until he finally buys in of this is sort of the only life I have left to live. And maybe she's right. She gives that whole, that cunt, I don't like using that word, but like, that's the speech she gives of like, I made you into the person you are. That's why you love me. That's why this makes sense. You're going to stay with me because you don't have any other choice. And he buys into it. I think he is sort of complicit by the end of like, yeah, you know what? You're right.
I don't know if it's as easy as that, but I agree. He is buying into that. I think I love that phrase actually. And I have always been squeamish about that word historically, but in the last few years I've been like, you know what? Fuck it. So I love that she owns this language about herself. Like, listen, she's not a feminist superhero, don't get me wrong, but there are things about her that you're like, wow, she is just so fucking unapologetically herself. And she calls out the things that other people won't. And what I do like here is the way that she challenges Nick. And she is like, hey, the only time you even liked yourself was when you were trying to be somebody that this cunt liked. Like, you're fucking welcome. And it's an interesting gauntlet to throw, to be honest, of like, what does that mean, right? Like, what does that mean for him? What does that mean for her? What does that mean for them? And you can tell that at the very least, it gives him pause of, you're right. Was I the best version of myself when I was trying to impress you and win you and woo you? And I just got tired because that's hard and it's an ongoing game. And you get the sense that this is a game that is not allowed to end. There is never an end to this game. If you are going to impress her and live with her and have a marriage with her, this is a lifelong game. Yeah. And is that what you signed up for?
You have to maintain this level with Amy, because I found myself asking that this time of, is this what she really wants? Like, is she a practical thinker of, oh, she saw him on TV being as kind of manipulative as she's been. Mm-hmm. And calling her home, and she saw that and she said, that's the Nick that I fell in love with. Is that really how she feels? And if so, what does that mean for their relationship going forward? And how do they sort of maintain this dynamic without it eventually exploding? It's an interesting ending.
I think it's, I agree that it is. And I think it's supposed to be, right? I think it's supposed to be questioning of, is there a possibility that they find their way back to each other,
right,
because they recognize these realities in each other, despite everything that she has done? Is she the most aware of him as a person and vice versa? And is he the only person that can accept and love her for who she is and vice versa? And I think that's a very interesting premise here with the challenges that have been thrown, the gauntlets that have been thrown. And I think you're supposed to see, like you said, I actually think you're supposed to see them as both complicit by the end of whether it's good or bad. Like, they're now going to go forward and live this life together. That's the commitment to the bit that we are now seeing, and it's going to yield some kind of result. And it's all just a big question mark. And I do think it's a very aggressive but unabashed view of how and when does marriage tear each other down, and when and do you compromise for the betterment of that future, if at all? And if you decide not to get divorced because of things like this, what does that look like? You know, how does that manifest? And I think it's supposed to be one big question mark. I think it's very interesting. I agree. I think it's a really interesting ending.
Yeah.
Oof. Okay. So, man, I actually think it's a great movie. I really love it. I think it's a good time. It's really a tough watch in a lot of ways, but I think it's very well done. So anyway, what's your rating?
I'm going to go pretty high on this one. Again, second rewatch, and it does take, like I said, a little time to settle in. I don't love the dialogue in the first 15, 20 minutes. That's the only part where it just feels a little off.
See, I'm such a sucker for that. It's so funny.
It's a little like Aaron Sorkin as well, like West Wing.
Which I love Aaron Sorkin.
But I'm going to go pretty high. I do want to give a shout out to, you know, we were brainstorming movies for this month. I think the reason Gone Girl was fresh in my mind, I want to give a shout out to my friend Genevieve, who at a party a couple weeks ago threatened to, she turned it into a verb. She threatened to Gone Girl her boyfriend, Eric, as like a way to, you know, spice up the relationship. Like, I'm going to Gone Girl you. I'm just like,
fuck with it. He should be a little afraid. I get it.
That stuck with me. So I think I wouldn't have suggested this title right off the bat for this month if that hadn't been fresh in my head. So shout out to her.
I hear you,
that
Genevieve.
Being said, I'll go 8.5. I think this is a great piece of cinema. I don't think it's perfect, but I just, it's so captivating from front to back, even when you know what's happening. Even when you know how it plays out, it is still so cool to watch the first 45 minutes to 60 minutes and see Nick play this all wrong and to know what's really happening in the background. And then it's a three-act structure, and every act is something completely different. So I'm going to go 8.5.
Ah, I love it. I'm so excited because, I mean, I love when Lamar and I argue, but I actually maybe love more when we agree. So I love this movie also. This is one of those, I don't know about you, but like, I think there are always movies where you can watch them over and over again and you don't really get tired of them, even if you've seen them an absurd amount. That is this movie for me, among others, but this is one of those. And I find different aspects of it that I like every time. I really enjoy the structure. I think it's very well written. It's very well performed. It's beautifully shot, all the things. And I love, again, I read the book. I love the book. And I love some of the things they say about the book, like terrifying, razor sharp, sinister, wickedly clever, menacing. Like all of that so resonates with me. And I think it makes this story so interesting and the writing so strong. So yeah, I hard agree. I would give this like an 8.5 or a 9 for all the times that I have enjoyed watching this and not ever gotten tired of it. So yeah, I think it's great.
Awesome
first Love Stinks entry. I'm so excited we did it. And also thanks for joining us on that one. That was a ride, but I think it was a really worthwhile one. Come back next week for another entry where we're going to talk about, I think also a really great one, but wildly different, Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind.
One of my all-time favorite films. I think it's in my top 10. Every time I watched it at the Draft House on the big screen for the first time since it came out like a few years ago and like teared up all over again. So a movie that can get an emotional reaction out of me every time I watch it always seems to hit home. And I think it's a great, great story.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a hot minute, actually, but I have definitely, every time I've seen it in the past, I've really loved it. I think I've seen it maybe 3 or 4 times, something like that. I really enjoy it. So I'm interested to see how it'll be on a rewatch over several years later. But I agree. I do remember it being an emotional one. So that's it. Well, you'll get some feelings out of us next week, hopefully. But in the meantime,
follow us on our socials at We Drink and We Watch Things, mostly Instagram, occasionally TikTok. You can also email us at We Drink and We Watch Things Pod at Gmail with any episode ideas, feedback, fuck ups. I don't know. Whatever you want to send there.
Yeah, spam. I'd be fascinated to hear what we get when we open the floodgates. Fuck ups galore. There are plenty of them, I'm sure. All right. Well, thanks for joining us. Like we said, for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers.